From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark, in for April Bear. Today, it's a race against time as vaccine eligibility expands in Michigan, but new variants of COVID-19 continue to spread throughout the state.
It's really hard to get a handle on exactly what the future is going to hold. Most of the epidemiologists I talk to say, I wish I had a crystal ball.
Then we dive into the latest dust-up between Governor Whitmer and Republican leaders over non-disclosure agreements and payouts to former employees.
The public is missing out on a large swath of documents that lay the foundation for decisions that affect their daily lives.
Then acclaimed actor and musician Jeff Daniels on writing new songs during a year of COVID.
It's been my answer, I'll tell you that. I've been more reclusive than J.D. Salinger. I am in a bunker and have been.
Those stories and more coming up. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark, in today for April Bear. On the show, non-disclosure agreements, payouts to former employees, the continuing dust-up over transparency in Lansing. And we'll check in with Michigan's Jeff Daniels about the music he's making 1 year into the pandemic. But first, all Michigan residents 50 and over are eligible for the COVID-19 vaccine. And anyone over 16 in Michigan with underlying health conditions or disabilities, eligible today as well. But COVID-19 cases in the state are increasing.
I know it's getting warmer, vaccines are rolling out, and people are tired of this pandemic. But we're not out of the woods yet. And we could potentially be at the beginning of another surge in Michigan.
That was Chief Medical Executive Dr. Jonay Khaldun on Friday. So can enough vaccines get administered to stem this spike, or are we indeed at the beginning of another surge? Kristen Jordan-Shamus of the Detroit Free Press is watching the numbers. Hi, Kristen.
Hi, how are you today?
I'm good. How are you doing?
Fantastic. Thanks.
Oh, I'm glad to hear it. So can you put this into context? Just where do things stand right now in terms of the number of COVID cases in Michigan?
Absolutely. So we are seeing an increase in cases and in hospitalizations, and it's not just a blip. That's what health officials are all noticing right now. They're saying there is something definitely going on here. The question is, what is it? What's driving these cases and these case numbers to rise? And what's putting more people into hospital beds from COVID-19? And, you know, the answer that I've gotten from a lot of people who are watching this, from epidemiologists and health officials, is that we're seeing now in Michigan the spread of the B.1.1.7 variant, which is also known as the United Kingdom variant or UK variant. It's a more transmissible, more contagious strain of the virus, and it's starting to spread more widely in Michigan right now. And with that more contagious version of the virus, more people are getting exposed and more people are getting sick. And so we're seeing that variant spreading. We're also in a situation where people are really tired of having to live in a more restrained way, right? We're tired of having to stay home. We're tired of wearing masks. We're tired of, you know, all the limits that have been placed upon us for the past year. And so people are letting down their guard, and they might be getting together in ways that they didn't months ago. And that's also contributing to spread.
From a statewide perspective, then, I mean, even Dr. Anthony Fauci brought up Michigan in this past week, saying this is a state he is concerned about. How worried do we need to be?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, we've been able to put vaccines into the arms of about one quarter of Michiganders who are eligible for vaccines right now. And so the question is, have we vaccinated enough people, especially vulnerable people, right? Those folks who are more likely to end up in the hospital or more likely to end up dying from the virus. Have we vaccinated enough of them to prevent this wave of cases from causing a lot of death and a lot of really severe illness? And the jury's still out on that. I mean, I think a lot of people are really hoping that we're getting the vaccine out quickly enough and that those most vulnerable people have gotten their shots. But I guess we'll find out. It's really hard to get a handle on exactly what the future is going to hold. Most of the epidemiologists I talk to say, I wish I had a crystal ball, but I don't.
So does it feel like that we are at this point where rather than dialing back restrictions, right, or should I say dialing forward, putting more restrictions in place about how we live our daily lives, that we are at a point right now where it appears that what we're trying to do is just vaccinate, 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 rather than, you know, get restaurants back down to 25%, let's say, or closing certain things again? Like, is that just sort of where we're at as a state, is that it needs to just be about shots and arms and not shutting things back down?
Well, yes and no. If you remember on Friday, Governor Whitmer and the state health department announced that they are going to start a testing protocol, like a regimen for youth athletes, right? So for kids ages 13 to 19 who participate in sports, whether that's through their school or through a club. And the reason is because one of the places where we're seeing some pretty decent amount of spread of the virus is among these young athletes. And the hope is that if we put these testing protocols in place, we'll be able to catch these cases. Because a lot of times kids are asymptomatic carriers of the virus, so they don't even know they have it. And they're going about their lives like, you know, nothing's wrong. And they're continuing to participate in sports. And then they may be spreading the virus to other people and spreading infection. And so the idea is that with this testing protocol, we'll be able to catch those cases, those kids, before they bring it home to their moms and their dads and their grandmas and grandpas and aunts and uncles.
And the folks that you've been talking to, is that enough? Will that testing be enough to try to stem this possible surge?
You know, we're really not sure. One of the epidemiologists I talked to for a story that was published in the Free Press on Sunday said we might be in a situation where we have to choose between face-to-face instruction in schools and youth sports. You know, which one do we want more? We've asked most school districts in the state to resume face-to-face learning, right? We've tied that to a funding protocol, of a funding model, and said, if you want this money, you have to have at least, you know, 20 hours of in-person instruction in your district. So we're requiring kids to go back to school full-time. But is offering the sports where we're seeing transmission asking too much? And that's a question we're going to have to see what happens with. We'll have to see if this testing protocol is enough to catch those asymptomatic cases and keep them from spreading. And we'll have to see, too, if it's spreading other places, not just among youth athletes, whether there are other spots in the state that might be sources of outbreaks that we might want to tame in the future.
We're talking with Kristen Jordan-Shamus of the Detroit Free Press. Today, all Michigan residents 50 and over are eligible for the COVID-19 vaccine, and anyone over 16 in Michigan with underlying health conditions or disability eligible as well today. So, Kristen, with that, we're over, you know, 2 million Michiganders having already gotten at least one dose of a COVID-19 vaccine. When do epidemiologists that you talk to say we're going to hit that sweet spot, right? The state says their goal is to immunize 70% of Michiganders 16 and older. Where do we need to be in terms of vaccines to start saying, okay, we're on a trajectory where spikes and surges may not happen anymore?
I think we need to get to that 70% range. It's with these variants that are more transmissible now circulating, we need to really get as many people vaccinated as possible. And that 70% range might not even be enough. And some of the experts, including Dr. Fauci and including, you know, our own state epidemiologist, have said that the range might be closer to 90 to 95% of people vaccinated if we have these variants circulating, just because they are so catchy.
So let's talk about these shots. Is the state getting enough right now to really be able to open eligibility as we are today? Everyone over 50 in 2 weeks, everyone 16 plus. Is there enough to be able to vaccinate that kind of number of Michiganders?
Well, we're starting to see a big increase in the number of vaccine doses that we're getting here in Michigan. This week, we did have a little boost in Pfizer's allocation. Moderna's came in about the same as it's been. But then we have the addition of the doses coming to Ford Field, and the federal government is supplying 6,000 extra doses a day to the people who get vaccinated at Ford Field and then also who take part in the mobile clinics that are happening in Wayne, Oakland, Macomb counties and in the city of Detroit that are tied to that federal program. So that's 6,000 people additional a day who wouldn't have had access to vaccines who now do. And that doesn't include the Johnson & Johnson allocation. The state told us we were expecting to get Johnson & Johnson vaccines again this week, but they didn't have any numbers for us when I last talked to state health officials on Friday. So I'm not sure how much of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine we'll be getting in the state, but we do know that those numbers are supposed to ramp up in the coming weeks, and hopefully it will be enough.
When we look again in this moment of time where we're at, and Dr. Khaldun saying, you know, we could possibly be seeing a surge and that we're in it right now, what are you watching for? Let's say just even in the next couple of days in terms of numbers, you know, up to a week, what are you keeping an eye on as you look at this spike?
Hospitalizations. I'm looking at the hospital numbers, the number of beds that are filled right now with COVID-19 patients, and the number of ICU beds that are filled with COVID-19 patients. I'm looking to see whether hospitals are saying that they are strained. And the hope is that they won't be, because as we know, these vaccines do provide some protection. Even if you do end up contracting the virus after you've been vaccinated, they're supposed to prevent people from severe illness. And so my hope is that this time around, we're not going to see the huge spike in hospitalizations like we saw last time and the crush on our hospitals. And then, of course, deaths are a lagging indicator, right? So we won't see the deaths follow for another couple of weeks, probably, maybe another week or two on this rise of cases. But maybe the death rate won't be as high this time. Maybe we won't see as many people die. And that's what I'm really hoping for. And that's what I'm watching.
Kristen Jordan-Shamus of the Detroit Free Press, thank you so much for all of your work covering the coronavirus in Michigan and helping folks across the state better understand where we are today.
Thanks so much. It's always great talking to you.
Still to come, Jeff Daniels talks about a year of lockdown and his latest album while spending a year at home in Michigan.
You know, I wish we were doing better. I wish we were all taking it seriously. I don't know what it's going to take for some people to take it seriously. But in the meantime, I am. So, you know, stay away from me.
That's after the break. Stay with us. You're with Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark, and today for April Bear, we're going to revisit my conversation now with one of Michigan's favorite sons, Jeff Daniels. During the year of COVID, the acclaimed actor, playwright, and musician found a way to keep things interesting. He hosted a series of virtual concerts, and he released a new album called Alive and Well Enough. I spoke with Jeff earlier this year.
Hey there, America, I got some breaking news. Hey there, America, I got some breaking news. I got that President Trump dumped it. What the hell you gotta lose?
Jeff Daniels, welcome back to Stateside.
Nice to be here.
So I don't know about you, but I feel like everyone asks each other during the pandemic how they're doing, and no one really knows what to say. You know, like you say, oh, I'm okay, or I'm holding up. And then I heard the title of your album, Alive and Well Enough, and I sort of thought that's the answer to how are you holding up.
It's been my answer, I'll tell you that. I've been more reclusive than J.D. Salinger. I am in a bunker and have been. And, you know, staying safe. And now we got new variants and maybe you're getting a vaccine. Maybe you're not. Depends on the day, which way the wind's blowing. I mean, we're still in the middle of it. So I'm alive and well enough kind of says it all.
And so that really has been sort of your response to this.
Yeah, many of us take it seriously. And this is what we have to do is stay inside, stay away from people as much as we can. Try to stop the spread of this thing, try to get on the other side of it. It's you know, I wish we were doing better. I wish we were all taking it seriously. I don't know what it's going to take for some people to take it seriously, but in the meantime, I am. So, you know, stay away from me.
So you're in Michigan. What has it been like? I mean, you are a political observer, and then, you know, you take what you see and you put it into your acting and your music. What has it been like to see your state, Michigan, over the past year? I'm thinking whether it be guns at the Capitol back in April, a governor, you know, and this FBI and this hostage situation. You know, what has that been like to watch your state go through?
Well, we've always been a swing state for a reason. We're not one or the other. We're both. And we live next to each other. But that was when we could talk to each other. That was when Tip O'Neill and Ron Reagan could sit in a room and work something out. That was when Boehner and Obama almost did. And that's not the case anymore. And I look at it more as the Republican Party having to decide whether it wants to continue as one thing or the other and deal with it. I think it's an in-house internal problem right now inside the Republican Party. You could see it coming as soon as Trump took over. And now guys like Rob Portman, who just said, I'm not coming back after 2022. Other guys, Jeff Flake, Bob Corker, others have just said, this is going in a direction I don't understand. And I think Mitch McConnell and Kevin McCarthy and Liz Cheney and Josh Hawley, they all got to sit in a room and figure it out, because it's not going to continue the way it is. It just won't. And I think there are a lot of Republicans that have to decide if they want to stay on this bandwagon or not. You know, so it's not just about your tax cuts anymore, folks.
And you're taking some of that thoughts. And I mean, you're like, you know, turning it into these themes. And one of the songs I want you to tell me a little bit about is Come a Little Closer. And that was written, in November 2016, right after Trump won?
A couple days after he won. It was a buckle up song. You could see it coming.
Once upon a time, long ago, for all I believed got the old heave-ho. Remember to remember the Alamo. Come a little closer to me. The apocalypse is coming, sorry, gotta run. The odds on tomorrow now are 2-1. Someone just said something about a setting sun. Come a little closer to me. Old man river, have mercy on me. The devil's at the bottom of the deep blue sea. As Clark Gable said to Vivian Lee, come a little closer to me.
And then who knew? Who knew what would happen over the course of those 4 years leading up to January 6th? Yeah, the album deals with a lot of that. Certainly Come a Little Closer to Me opens that. Trumpty Dumpty Blues is on there. That was me writing in April, a month into the pandemic, when he got on television and invited us all to attend Easter service with him. I just couldn't take it anymore. And I Am America is a song that I co-wrote with Thornetta Davis.
Let me live. Let me breathe.
That deals with the not only post George Floyd, but post Trayvon Martin, post Michael Brown, post Breonna Taylor. I mean, on and on and on and on. And then you read Isabel Wilkerson's book, Cast, and you go, this is 400 years. This is 400 years. And I think that's what's going on right now. We are dealing with or confronting, maybe once and for all, systemic racism. We'll see how we do.
Like I was raised to do. Cause America. We all deserve the
dark behind a light in your eyes.
It's time for peace. There's no time for hate. We must stop all this fighting before it's too late.
Give me your tired.
I am tired.
Give me your poor.
But I am strong.
Give me your hand.
I'll be here.
And I will guide you.
Cause I know
you
I belong.
For I will rise up.
Freedom, give me my freedom, and I will rejoice. I am America. Yes, I am.
You co-wrote the song, as you said, I Am America, with just Detroit's beloved blues singer, Thornetta Davis. How'd that song, like, how did that come to be? Were you in Michigan? I mean, like, how does this work for musicians? You just call up your friends and go, man, this is intense. Let's jam. Like, give me some background.
I wrote it as a song of unity, as a song of, no, everyone has worth. As human beings, we're really all just one human being on one planet. That's where it kind of comes from. And then I wanted Thornetta, and I sent it to her, and I said, anything you don't like, change. Mm-hmm. And so everything she sings on the song, she wrote. And we had her come out to Chelsea, and it's just a statement as, you know, we can be a new America. We really can. We have far less to fear from each other than some people think. We can be better by being inclusive. We can be smarter. We can truly be the greatest country in the world, as Will McAvoy argued, if we deal with things like this. And I Am America gives value to everyone who is walking in this country. And so that's kind of where it came from. And then Thornetta took it over and turned it into like a prayer. It really becomes her prayer of, please, all I ask of you is to give me my freedom. That's all I ask.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with acclaimed actor, playwright, musician, and Michigander, Jeff Daniels. He's got a new album out titled Alive and Well Enough. Jeff, you've been doing these virtual concerts. What's it like performing virtually, right? Like, I'm thinking of you in front of these huge audiences, whether it's Broadway or, you know, seeing you play at the Michigan Theater, and you have these humans feeding back what you're putting out there. You don't have that with these more intimate concerts. What's that been like as an artist?
It took a little bit, not a long time, a little bit of time to figure out, because I've done so many movies and TV. I mean, it's like working in front of a camera. The difference is you're looking right down the barrel of the lens. You're talking to one person sitting on the other side of that lens, either on their couch or, you know, in their living room or on their laptop, wherever. But you're playing to one or two people on their couch. That's the trick. And so you don't have to shoot it as far. You don't have to send it to the balcony of a performing arts center or, you know, even a 200, 300 seat club. I miss the back and forth, because I do talk to the audience and get them going, and then, you know, have a little fun with them and then slide into the next song. But I don't have that. So I pretend that the person that's sitting on that couch is listening and interested, and that they think I'm funny. That's all you need, is a little positive push forward, and then you can roll through the show and kind of, you know, entertain them on their couch. And that's the trick. That's the trick. And it's been fun to do. Certainly the travel is a lot easier. You know, we're doing it from our recording studio here at home with my sons. And, you know, I'm making the best of it. I you can get a little more intimate, you know. You can deep tracks, as they say. You can play some stuff that you might not play if there were 300 people expecting to be entertained. you know, you can trust that maybe they'll handle this 10-minute story about Lanford Wilson and how the Pulitzer Prize winner handed you a poem called Road Signs and it ended up being this song. You know, that you can go there and then play Road Signs. And if someone is truly interested in listening from their couch, they're still with you. So that the assumption is there, and versus the immediate feedback of yes, they are, or no, they aren't, or man, I'd really like to hear a funny song now, and you can kind of feel it. You don't have to pay any attention to that. You can kind of do what you want to do.
And Road Signs is part of Jeff Daniels, who we're speaking to right now, his new album, Alive and Well Enough. Jeff, are you writing right now? I mean, you're playing, you said you were filming, you had to stop. Are you being as prolific of a writer as you've been before during this period of time?
I've been asked to write a couple of things, an essay for this, or Nora Guthrie called. She's doing a book about Woody, and she's having a bunch of people write introductions to certain chapters. So I was really honored to be asked to do that. It's mostly guitar work at this point. Certainly playing all these live streams, there's nobody else. It's just me and the acoustic. And you try to make that acoustic sound like a whole orchestra, you know, the low, the middle, and the high, if you're finger picking. And so I've been working, working on the next couple of musical ideas on the guitar that, of course, are far too complicated to play without practicing for 3 months. But I know they're good ones, so I'm going to stay at it. And that's kind of working, which is fun. That's a lot of fun for me, is to kind of, okay, here's a really good one that needs good lyrics, so don't just put anything on this. Meanwhile, try to learn how to play it. And that's kind of where I'm at.
And is this the same guitar from Herb David in Ann Arbor? Long gone Herb David, or are these new guitars that you're using?
I still have that. It was a Guild D40 that I bought for $400 out of Herb David in Ann Arbor, his guitar shop. And I bought a few of them from Herb. I still have it. It's not that guitar, but I still have it. It's hanging up.
I read something about during the pandemic, our dreams are getting weirder because we have less interactions like out in the world, right? And so our brains are coming up with things that maybe we haven't thought about for a dozen years. I wonder, as an artist who is writing songs, where are you getting songs from if you're not out in the world? I mean, obviously this latest album is political, so I assume you're getting it from Trump and DC, just reading the lyrics, and there's some poetry in there too. But what do you use for inspiration when you're on lockdown?
It is difficult because it's tricky. I'm not being very prolific right now. And I wonder if that's part of it. We're all dealing with the same thing. We're all in the same boat. And maybe that would be inspiring. So now you can write songs that everybody understands based on this thing that we're going through. Or there's nothing there. You're staring at a wall, you know, which is kind of what it feels like. So it's been tricky. I did write a little bit, and it was dealing with the pandemic, and then added some other songs that I thought fit the album. But I'm not writing anything new. Not quite sure why, but I'm not.
I think that's how a lot of folks are feeling right now.
Trying.
Before we let you go, I just want to ask, how is the Purple Rose Theater doing? You, of course, are the founder of this just magnificent theater in Chelsea. How's the theater holding up in the middle of the pandemic?
Well, we had a couple of really good years with the support from people for the theater and the box office. And so we were in a place where we could financially ride it out with a skeleton staff, which is what we're doing now, where we've retained the people that we're going to need to start over, basically. And it gives us a chance to kind of address some things that we want to do differently and just play selection, but also number of productions, and try to set the Purple Rose up so that it can live well beyond me and Guy Sandville, that it's time that we get ready to pass it on. And it needs to be in a place where it can sustain itself without having a, you know, celebrity at the top of it. And that'll be what we're doing when we come back is kind of reprogramming for that.
Well, I'm glad to hear that, and we're all sending our love to the Purple Rose Theater, who the co-founder is Jeff Daniels, and his new album, which I believe, if you're okay with it, I'm going to steal when anyone asks how you're doing during the pandemic. Just say alive and well enough.
Plagiarism is the sincerest form of flattery. Steal away. Yes.
Jeff Daniels, thanks so much, man.
All right. Thank you, Zoe. Take care.
Support for arts and culture coverage on Stateside comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs.
He's always right and he's never wrong. Always seemed to be where he don't belong. And just like that apple fell for Isaac Newton, so did Trump for Vladimir Putin. Just like a miracle, it's all
still to come. Talk over non-disclosure agreements and payouts to former state employees. We're going to dive into the latest dust-ups between Governor Whitmer and Republican legislative leaders over transparency in Lansing.
The public is missing out on a large swath of documents that, you know, lay the foundation for decisions that affect their daily lives.
That's coming up. Stay with us here on Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark, in for April Bear. When it comes to government transparency and accountability laws, Michigan ranks last out of all the states. A literal F grade. That's from a report from the Center for Public Integrity. Only two states, one of which is Michigan, fully exempt the executive and legislative branches from Freedom of Information Acts. Legislation that would make the state legislature and the governor's office subject to open record laws passed the state house last week. Meanwhile, a petition campaign that wants to expand access to public records is preparing a signature campaign to put a question on the ballot for voters. All of this, though, is happening in the background of continuing scrutiny of Governor Whitmer's use of a confidentiality agreement with Robert Gordon, a former cabinet head helping to oversee the state's COVID-19 response. Craig Mauger of the Detroit News and Emily Lawler of MLive have both been following these stories out of the Capitol. Hey, you two.
Hey, hello.
Hey, thanks for having us.
So, okay, let's start with the legislation that passed the state house regarding FOIA. It's now before the state Senate. It would open up the governor's office and the legislature. What exactly, like, would these bills do? Would they really help with that F grade?
Yeah, so, I mean, the bills would change the longstanding fact that we are one of two states that don't subject the governor's office or the legislature to any type of open records request. So in that sense, yes, these bills would change one of the key reasons that we're 50th out of 50 states for disclosure.
Yeah, but I think the question would really be how they're implemented. A lot of people have been calling attention to what seem like some areas of concern or loopholes. And I think that we've seen FOIA over the years become, you know, it can be a great tool for getting information. It can also be sort of a tool to throw blockades in the way, as I know that most reporters have experienced. But broadly, the law would subject the governor's office to the Freedom of Information Act. And create a separate new Legislative Open Records Act, or LORA, for the legislative branch.
So, Emily, what exactly, I mean, we throw out these words, FOIA, LORA, open records, but in actual practice, what does that look like, right? What are some files or papers or something right now that is shielded under these laws that suddenly the public, reporters, whomever, would be able to see?
Yeah, well, you know, random example, let's say that I wanted travel expenses from everyone from my local school board official, which I could get it from under FOIA, to the director of a state department. I could get that under FOIA. I could not get that from the governor's office or the legislature under FOIA. Now, the legislature has some rules where they disclose some sort of broad strokes financial implications under these requests. You know, the governor's office also does some voluntarily, but there's basically no law compelling the executive and legislative branches to give us the same information that we can get under open records laws from local governments or the state government more broadly.
Craig, what does that mean, do you think, for the public to not be able to have this information compared with other states where this is just sort of rightfully known to taxpayers if they ask for it?
Yeah, I mean, it's just the public is missing out on a large swath of documents that, you know, lay the foundation for decisions that affect their daily lives. I mean, the legislature and the governor, you know, create the laws that affect all of us on a daily basis. And these records, you know, some of them would not be subjected to this law. Many of them would, but we would get a better understanding under these proposals of what's behind some of the policy changes that are made. You know, an example of a possible request. If there is a bill that's pushed and we know that there's one particular lobbying group pushing that bill in the legislature, potentially we could request the documents of communication between the lawmaker who led the charge for that change and the lobbying entity that wanted the change. I mean, those are the type of records we could get. We could see what type of conversations were happening behind the scenes that led to a reform. And right now, we don't get that kind of sunlight on these type of records.
Craig, when you hear from those who aren't in favor of these laws, what are their main talking points? Like, what are the reasons that they give right now for voting against this kind of transparency?
Yeah, so the main pushback that I hear right now is from some lawmakers in the legislature who say, you know, there's a portion of the legislative process that they argue relies on trust and compromise. And if you bring sunlight to all of these documents, does that element of, you know, behind the scenes negotiation somehow get lost? I personally think that there's not a lot to that because there are many exemptions which within these bills that would prevent a lot of that type of conversation from being released. You know, you also hear the main topic of conversation in Lansing on this is how much of the communication between lawmakers and their constituents should be released. And currently this legislation says that communication between lawmakers and constituents is exempt from release under the proposal. So those are probably the two areas that I hear the most discussion and chatter on right now.
Emily, from you, what are you hearing?
Yeah, I mean, I think Craig hit the big ones there. And, you know, I think that it's hard for a public body to open itself up. But, you know, you look at the fact that 48 other states are doing this. And it seems like that argument just fades a little bit. And I think that we've seen that over the years, this has gained more support. But I'm not sure if that is going to translate into getting it over the hump finally in the Senate.
So we have lawmakers in the state house pass this last week unanimously, right? It is now in front of the Senate. We've got some bipartisan support in the Senate. But dare I say, we've seen this movie before. What is it, four times in the past 5 years this legislation has been passed in the House? The Senate kind of, you know, holds it up. What's the likelihood here of this passing?
I think it's gotten farther this time than in the past, not in the sense that it's passed the House, but that, of course, the Senate has some parallel legislation and there's going to be a hearing that's expected to take place on that. And, you know, I think that historically, you're right that this is sort of stopped at the Senate's doorstep and more specifically the Senate Majority Leader's doorstep, both under former Senate Majority Leader Arlen Meekoff, current Senate Majority Leader. Of course, Mike Shirkey. But, you know, the Senate has a bipartisan team championing this. And I think that that could help. I think that Ed McBroom, sort of the Republican half of the bipartisan Senate transparency team, has a lot on his shoulders and has some potential wiggle room to make this so that it's not the whatever number you cited, fifth or sixth time that this stops on the Senate doorstep.
Is some of the issue, too, that it's just like not that sexy of a topic, right? Like it's just this like we want more information and it doesn't seem, I was going to say, like redistricting or something like this or gerrymandering or, you know, that has sort of gotten attention statewide. Does this subject really have enough attention, sort of mass attention, grassroots attention?
I have not heard gerrymandering described as a sexy topic before.
As I was saying that, welcome to public radio. Welcome to public radio.
There's a lot of attention on this subject right now, and there's a multitude of reasons for why that is. And I think there is probably more inertia behind this at this moment than the last, you know, handful of times that this has stalled in the state Senate. Is it a sexy topic? Is it the sexiest topic that's out there right now? Probably not. But there's definitely momentum on the side of this right now. So it'll be interesting to see what happens in the next couple of weeks.
And we should note, too, as I mentioned, a petition campaign that wants to expand access to public records is preparing a signature drive, right, to put this question to voters. So it's sort of this full court press, right? Make it a ballot, have the legislature pick it up and really kind of drive it forward in a way that possibly it hasn't in sessions previously. So as I mentioned, all of this is happening while this story over Robert Gordon, the former head of the Michigan Department of Health and Human Services, which has had sweeping authority over the COVID-19 response in the state, he resigned in January. There have been a lot of rumors swirling about why he resigned, but no one in the public knows for sure because there was this confidentiality agreement between him and Governor Whitmer with a $155,000 contract. This all sort of feels tied into open government and transparency, or the lack thereof, doesn't it, Craig?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the reasons that this is in the spotlight right now, because we have a concrete example of how disclosure can inform the public and put out information that's not going to come out otherwise. I mean, Robert Gordon's separation agreement was released through open records requests and has led to this, you know, weeks long debate about whether these type of agreements should continue. And, you know, in the process of that, there have been reporters uncovering numerous other separation agreements through open records requests or other types of requests. So it's a real moment in time where not only is the debate happening in the legislature, but you have this ballot proposal being discussed, and you have real life examples of how open records requests provide crucial information to the public. So yeah, I think it's fascinating this is all happening at the same time.
Yeah, and I think that Craig gets some credit for making this subject really interesting at this particular moment. You know, without FOIA, Robert, you might not know about that $155,000 separation agreement. And that's one of the examples of, you know, maybe this isn't a sexy topic on paper. Maybe searching for documents doesn't sound very exciting. But, you know, if you were excited by that story, or if that made you feel some kind of way, that's exactly the kind of thing that comes up because we have FOIA laws.
How much of this, Emily, as we're talking about some Republicans in the Senate not wanting to push for the open records law, but really being angry, right, over these separation agreements, how much of it is really then truly wanting to be angry about Robert Gordon? And how much of it is just a political hammer against Whitmer, something that they found that they can hold on to?
Well, it's Lansing, so let's not rule out politics generally. But I think it's worth noting that, you know, these Senate Republicans, a lot of them come from the House. A lot of them have supported transparency legislation in the past, far before this was the issue that it is today before them in the Senate, and far before the Robert Gordon agreement. So I do think that there's sort of a goodwill consensus around a lot of this. But, you know, whether that translates into actual Senate action, I think is probably the sort of political question that you referenced.
And speaking of politics and all things seemingly equal at some point, a progressive advocacy group brought up this issue of separation agreements involving the legislature, in fact. Some $700,000 being spent in the legislature on staffers leaving. Craig, can you give us a little bit of a rundown of that and how that kind of fits along with the administration of Gretchen Whitmer using separation agreements as well?
Yeah, in some ways, it undercuts some of the attacks that Republicans have tried to levy against the Democratic governor of late, because the Senate, primarily the state Senate, has been somewhat routinely agreeing to separation deals that appear, according to one of them that we've reviewed, to include a confidentiality provision as well. The Senate's been doing this. You know, I think we tracked 20 of them over the past 5 years in the Senate, and Progress Michigan had tracked, I think, about 30 of them over a decade in the Senate. So this is something the Senate's been doing. You know, the lawmakers will say that the type of agreements that they're entering into are much smaller and of a different tone and reason than what the administration has done. But this is where it gets back to FOIA, like everything else. We don't have the actual agreements that the legislature is entering into. We have been pushing to try to get the text of those agreements, but because the legislature doesn't fall under any type of open records law, they don't feel like they have to release those agreements at this time. We believe, and others believe, that, you know, the way the law is written, that maybe the House and Senate Business Office would have to release these documents, but they haven't. So this is, again, getting back to the differing levels of transparency. Robert Gordon's deal had to be released because it was involving the Attorney General's office and the Department of Health, which fall under FOIA. The Senate and House deals don't have to be released because the legislature is exempt.
And Emily, we should note both the $155,000 with Robert Gordon, as well as this $700,000 in the state legislature. That's taxpayer money.
Yeah. And I mean, as Craig pointed out, there's that real dichotomy between the exact information that you can access from the Department of Health and Human Services versus the legislature. I mean, those are two very parallel documents that we would like to review from each entity. And because of the way open records laws are structured, we can only review that from DHHS. But yeah, the money that the legislature is spending is just as much yours as the money that MDHHS is spending.
And Craig, finally, you wrote about the Michigan Republican Party just last week and their use of confidentiality agreements, though we should note this is not taxpayer money at stake here. This is not necessarily public, but fill us in on this story from last week.
Yeah, this is more about the philosophical use of these agreements and whether they're actually silencing people's ability to speak out. As your listeners probably remember, there was a huge feud in the Republican Party's chair race, and the former chair, Laura Cox, lost her reelection bid to the new chair, Ron Weiser. And there has been a lot of accusations floating from Laura Cox's camp toward the current leadership of the Republican Party. And in late February, the current leadership of the Republican Party sent Laura Cox an email, a letter, I should say, telling her, you know, you signed a confidentiality agreement, and we may have to take legal action if you keep speaking out about what you're alleging Ron Weiser did. So this letter came less than a week before the Michigan Republican Party just started an all-out attack on Governor Whitmer over allegations that she's using separation agreements with confidentiality clauses to silence people. So it's one of those things where at this moment, there don't appear to be any clean hands in Lansing when it comes to these type of agreements. It's just a matter of degree of how much money is involved and how you feel about these agreements as a whole.
Well, on that cheery note, of the Detroit News, Emily Lawler of MLive, thank you so much. It is a really beautiful, sunshiny day, so I liked all of the talk about opening up sunshine into state government. That's so dorky to say, but true.
Well, thank
agreed.
You.
Thanks.
And that's Stateside for today. I'm Zoe Clark in for April Bear. Stateside is produced by Aaron Allen, Mike Blank, April Van Buren, and our director, Mercedes Mejia, with additional help from Catherine Newhen, Nell Ovett, and Olive Scott. Our executive producer is Laura Weber Davis. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. Thank you so much for listening.